the disciples came to Jesus, saying, "Where will you have us prepare for you to eat the Passover?" He said, "Go into the city to a certain man and say to him, 'The teacher says, my time is at hand. I will keep the Passover at your house with my disciples.'" And the disciples did as Jesus directed them, and they prepared the Passover. When it was evening, he reclined at table with the 12. And as they were eating, he said, "Truly I say to you, one of you will betray me." And they were very sorrowful, and began to say to him one after another, "Is it I, Lord?" He answered, "He who has dipped his hand in the dish with me will betray me. The Son of Man goes as it is written of him, but woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would have been better for that man if he had not been born." Judas, who would betray him, answered, "Is it I, Rabbi?" He said to him, "You have said so." Now as they were eating, Jesus took bread, and after blessing it, broke it and gave it to the disciples, and said, "Take, eat, this is my body." And he took a cup, and when he had given thanks, he gave it to them, saying, "Drink of it, all of you, for this is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. I tell you, I will not drink again of this fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it anew with you in my Father's kingdom."
You can be seated. It is such an honor and privilege to have you gather together with us tonight. We have folks from our Smyrna campus, some folks from our Riverdale campus, some folks from our Seward's Creek campus, and man, it is an amazing thing when we all come together and just thank you for being here. It's spring break, and man, we are delighted to have you. We also have folks in an overflow room, and so, man, I'm sorry that, I hate to apologize for that, but, man, I do, I know, but it's just like I don't think there's a seat in the house, so thank you for the sacrifice of being in the overflow room. And so, Kyle Narcy, thank you for doing a great job with your campuses. We have the greatest staff of any church I've ever seen. And I am so thankful for the guys who help guide and steer and lead this place. We're gathered here tonight for a very special reason. It's not a random, typical Friday night. This is a very special Friday night. It's the most special Friday night on the Christian calendar leading up to the most special Sunday, as every Sunday is special, but this Sunday is the most special Sunday on the Christian calendar. It has been for 2,000 years. We gather tonight to remember, to literally celebrate, if I can, the most horrific, brutal, and unjust death in human history. I mean, just as Isaiah prophesied 700 years earlier, Jesus was beaten and tortured so badly that he was not even recognizable as a human. Isaiah said that people would turn their heads in horror as they wouldn't even recognize him as a human being, and that is exactly what happened. And we call this Good Friday, and that's an amazement to the lost world, to people who don't know Jesus. They're wondering and trying to figure out, why do we call this good? And it seems anything but good. And tonight what we want to do is to help you to understand that by taking you through three scenes. In order to understand why it's so good, you have to understand the story that it fulfills. And so we're going to take you through three scenes tonight to help you get your mind around what is so good and why we would even use the word rather than just reflection, but even a celebration as we look and come to this time tonight. The first scene that we're taking you to is the upper room scene. It's the upper room. You know, it is Passover week in Jerusalem 2,000 years ago. It's Thursday night of Passover week, and Jesus is meeting with his disciples to celebrate the Passover meal. Now, the town was bustling. It was slammed with people. It was like Dollywood at spring break. I mean, there were people everywhere. I mean, there were lines, there were crowds, there were traffic jams, there were people all over the city because they had come from all over the world to celebrate the most important event in the history of Israel. They came to celebrate Passover, which was a festival where they remembered their most important event, which was deliverance from slavery in Egypt. You see, for over 400 years, God's people were enslaved to Egypt. But they prayed, they cried out to God for a deliverer, and God answered their prayer by sending a deliverer named Moses. Moses goes to Egypt and he tells Pharaoh to let God's people go, but Pharaoh laughed. He thought he was a god, and he laughed, and in so doing, God brought 10 plagues upon Egypt. Not because he needed 10 plagues to get the job done, but each one of those plagues was revealing something about who God was, and he was taking out one of the Egyptian gods in the process. The final plague, some of you know well, others of you may be new to church, and the final plague was the taking of the firstborn in all of Egypt, firstborn animal, firstborn human being. But God told the Israelites, here's what I will do to save you. If you will slaughter a one-year-old lamb without blemish, meaning that it was in the prime of its life and it was perfection, without blemish, slaughter that lamb, consume that lamb, put its blood on the doorposts of your home, and when you put its blood on the doorposts of your home, when I bring judgment, I will pass over the homes marked by the blood of the lamb. And it happened just as God said. The firstborn of all Egypt were killed. They were gone, but all of the Israelites who had marked their homes with the blood of the Lamb were saved. They were redeemed. And just as God said they would, and God told them to celebrate, to remember this with a festival each year called Passover. For 1,500 years, Israel had gathered together to remember God brought us out of Egypt. And that is exactly the meal that Jesus was eating with his disciples that night. It was a very special meal, much like when you would gather for your family Christmas meal, or when you gather on Easter for Easter lunch, maybe, whatever your tradition says. This was a very important meal. And they were setting in an upper room somewhere in Jerusalem. And they were, and as they were at a table, and it was basically a three-sided table called a triclinium, and it was a low table. They would recline on their left elbow. They would eat with their right hand. And on that table before them that night, as much as you can imagine as your Christmas meal, you have special things that are on your menu every year. You have dishes that are tradition. You have things that you like. That's the same with Passover. But they weren't just tradition. They weren't just preferential dishes. Each item on that table had a very significant symbolism. Each item had a story. It represented a story of hope and redemption. Each item on that table. There would have been hard-boiled eggs on that, what we would call a Seder table, on that Passover table, the hard-boiled eggs, and they would take those hard-boiled eggs, and this was a time when they would not only remember, but teach their children the most important things that they could ever learn, how God had intervened in their life. And they took these hard-boiled eggs to teach their children how that, you know, everything that's boiled in water either becomes soft or it disintegrates completely. But eggs are different. Eggs, when they're boiled in water, they get hard. And they would teach their children how Israel in slavery became hardened in slavery. They didn't melt. They didn't disintegrate, but they became hardened. There was on the table bitter herbs, and the bitter herbs would remind them of the bitterness that they had in slavery in Egypt. There were greens on the table, parsley, celery, and these parsley and celery, they would take these before they would eat, and they would go through a whole process, but they would teach their kids about hope. There is hope. We were enslaved, but there's hope. These greens remind us of spring and hope. But there was also salt water on that table, bowls of salt water where they would take the greens and they would dip those greens into the salt water to remind their children, to remind them of the tears, the many tears, 400 years of tears that they shed, that they cried in slavery. There was the Heroset. The Heroset was on the table. It was a mixture of nuts and cinnamon and apples and wine. And they had that there, and it was the best representation to represent the mortar that they would make with the mud and the straw to build Pharaoh's treasured cities. And they had that to represent their hard labor. Then they would talk to their kids about hard labor and what they were made to do for 400 years. Then there was the matzah, which was the unleavened bread. It's on the table, and the matzah was there to as they would teach their children, we had to leave in haste. I mean, man, we were enslaved. We could not save ourselves, but when God did it, he did it, and we had to get out in haste, and we had to take bread that wasn't leavened. And they would talk about how God brought them out quickly. And then there was the most important thing on the table was the lamb. But before they would, in the process of this meal, there were 4 cups of wine. And they would take 4 cups of wine to teach their children and for them to remember. And these were very important cups of wine. And each one of them had a very important symbolic reference. I'm going to read to you from Exodus chapter 6, verses 6 through 8. And here's what Moses writes in Exodus. He says, "Say therefore to the people of Israel, I am the Lord, and I will bring you out from under the burden of the Egyptians. And I will deliver you from slavery to them, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with great acts of judgment. I will take you to be my people, and I will be your God, and you shall know that I am the Lord your God who has brought you out from under the burden of the Egyptians. I will bring you into the land that I swore to give to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob. I will give it to you for a possession. I am the Lord." And so God used 4 expressions in those 4 glasses of wine. He used 4 expressions as he told them what to do, and each of those glasses of wine represented one of these expressions. God said, "I will take you out." God said, "I will deliver," or "I will save you." God said, "I will redeem you." And God said, "I will take you to be my people." And they would talk about how God said, "I will take you out." And they would raise a glass of wine and they would toast what God had done. Then they would teach their children, "God said, I will save you." And they would raise their glass and they would toast. And they would say, "God said, I will take you to be my people." They would raise their glass. These are the cups of wine. Each of these things was telling a story. Jesus was doing this with his disciples that night. It was an amazing meal. It was one of their most favored meals of the year. He had done this for 33 years as a good Jew. For the last 2 years, this would be his third with these disciples. And he's teaching these disciples as we would be teaching our kids. But the most important thing on that table was the lamb. It was the most important thing on that table. The lamb. They would take the lamb. They would talk about how the lamb, the blood of the lamb, we slaughtered the lamb. It was a perfect lamb. It had no blemish. It was 1 year old. It was in the prime of its life. And we slaughtered that lamb. And we put the blood on our doorpost, kids. And God passed over us. He passed over us. And the kids would begin to understand as much as they could what was going on at their age. And that's what Jesus, that night, with his disciples, the lamb. Don't you know when he came to the lamb and to the wine that night, each time, man, it got a little intense as he was talking about the lamb, knowing what was about to happen, as he was toasting with the wine. And he enjoyed this meal. He did a lot of things, but he enjoyed this time with his disciples. And then after they celebrated the meal, it says that they sang a hymn and they went out to the Mount of Olives. The Mount of Olives was just across the valley from Jerusalem. That's where it lies, olive trees, and it's an olive garden, and it's just across. And it says that they sang a hymn, and they went across the valley to the Mount of Olives. Let's stand right now, and as Benji leads us in a hymn, let's sing together just as Jesus and his disciples did that night.
His love for us, how vast beyond all measure, that he would give his only son to make a wretch his treasure. How great the pain of searing loss, the Father turns his face away as wounds which mar the chosen one bring many sons to glory. Behold the man upon a cross, my sin upon his shoulders, ashamed.
Then Jesus went with them to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to his disciples, "Sit here while I go over there and pray." And taking with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, he began to be sorrowful and troubled. Then he said to them, "My soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch with me." And going a little farther, he fell on his face and prayed, saying, "My Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will." And he came to the disciples and found them sleeping. And he said to Peter, "So could you not watch with me 1 hour? Watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit is indeed willing, but the flesh is weak." Again, for the second time, he went away and prayed, "My Father, if this cannot pass unless I drink it, your will be done." And again he came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were heavy. So, leaving them again, he went away and prayed for the third time, saying the same words again. And then he came to the disciples and said to them, "Sleep and take your rest later on. See, the hour is at hand, and the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand.
You can take a seat. The second scene that we want to move into tonight to help you grasp the significance of what's going on and why this is so good is the garden. The garden is called Gethsemane. Now, I want you to think for just a moment about something that most of us don't like to think about, but I think it's very helpful, is what would you do if you knew that you only had a few hours to live, less than a day? I mean, if you had less than 12 hours, if you had a few hours to live, what would you do? I highly doubt you would count your money. I highly doubt you would check your 401k and see what the performance of your 401k is. I don't think that you would be trying to plan a remodel of your house or your next vacation. What I really think you would do is, if you knew that you only had a few hours to live, man, you'd spend it with your family. You'd want to be with your wife or your husband and your kids and your family. You know, that's exactly where we find Jesus, in the garden. He goes across to the garden of the valley, to the Garden of Gethsemane, Mount of Olives, and Jesus knows that the meal he just had with his disciples would be the last meal. He knows that he will be arrested in just a few hours, and he will be placed on an expedited death row, and he will be tried and convicted in a trumped-up court tonight. He knows this. He knows that he's about to die, and not just die a painless death by lethal injection, but a very painful death. He knows this. So what does he do with those few hours? Well, what he did was, he didn't try to preach one more sermon. He didn't try to heal one more person. He didn't try to teach his disciples one more lesson. That's not what he did. What he wanted to do and what he did was spend time with the Father. So he takes his disciples and he goes to the garden and he begins to talk to the Father. And in Gethsemane, by the way, Gethsemane means oil press. It means oil press. It was an olive garden, and an oil press is a press where olives were crushed and oil, the olive oil, would flow. And before Jesus was nailed to a cross, Jesus was crushed in the garden, folks. You know, olives are crushed and oil flowed, and Jesus in Gethsemane was crushed and salvation flowed for all those who would believe. Luke tells us that he was so stressed. He was crushed emotionally. He was so stressed that his sweat was filled with blood. That wasn't just hyperbole, as it says blood was streaming down his face with his sweat. And we might think that's hyperbole. We might think that's, man, it's just talking about intent. It's not. That's a real medical condition called hematidrosis. It's when your subcutaneous capillaries are under so much pressure, they burst. And blood comes and mingles with your sweat, and blood can run down your face. It's a very real condition. That's how crushed Jesus was. You know, if you're ever stressed and crushed, Jesus knows exactly how you feel. He was crushed that night. He was so crushed that he asked God, Father, please let this cup pass from me. Let this cup pass from me. What was he talking about? You see, the cup in the Old Testament was a symbol of the wrath or the judgment of God. And so when Jesus said, let this cup pass from me, he was talking about bearing God's wrath and God's judgment against the sins of all who would believe. He concluded, although he said, Father, I don't want to do this. I would rather not do this. Is there any other way that we can do this? Nevertheless, not my will, but yours. He felt the weight. He felt the weight, but he chose obedience, folks. He felt the weight, but he chose obedience. He didn't ask for the cup to be removed because he was weak or because he was afraid. He asked for the cup to be removed because he was fully aware of what was about to endure in just a few hours. He knew that he was about to be treated as sin itself. We think of Jesus' death, and maybe we think of it as an event. But Jesus didn't just die. It wasn't just his death. It was the fact that he absorbed God's wrath on our behalf. He absorbed it. It wasn't just any death. It was an absorption as he was absorbing God's wrath that I deserve, really that you deserve. He was absorbing it. He was paying the price that we could never pay so that we could get what only he had. He was absorbing it. The cup, folks, wasn't just death. It was judgment. It wasn't just nails. It was wrath. It wasn't just suffering. It was separation from the Father. And Jesus didn't just sip it. He willingly drank every drop so all who would believe wouldn't have to. I want you to think about that for just a moment. I just described grace. I just described substitutionary atonement. I just described someone who Martin Luther calls it a great exchange. He took our sin. He absorbed the wrath for our sin, and he gave us his righteousness. Wow. You're beginning to see why it's so good? You're beginning to see why we call this good? What I want us to do right now is sing again as we reflect on the garden scene coming out of the upper room. We'll come back in a moment and look at the crucifixion or the cross.
Man of sorrows, Lamb of God, by his own betrayed, the sin of men and wrath of God has been crown
the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the governor's headquarters, and they gathered the whole battalion before him. And they stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him, and twisting together a crown of thorns, they put it on his head and put a reed in his right hand. And kneeling before him, they mocked him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And they spit on him and took the reed and struck him on the head. And when they had mocked him, they stripped him of the robe and put his own clothes on him and led him away to crucify him. And when they came to a place called Golgotha, which means place of a skull, they offered him wine to drink, mixed with gall. But when he tasted it, he would not drink it. And when they had crucified him, they divided his garments among them by casting lots. Then they sat down and kept watch over him there. And over his head they put the charge against him, which read, "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." Now from the sixth hour there was darkness over all the land until the ninth hour. And about the ninth hour Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, "Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani?" That is, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And Jesus cried out again with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit. And behold, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom, and the earth shook, and the rocks were split. The tombs also were opened, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. And coming out of the tombs after his resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many. When the centurion and those who were with him, keeping watch over Jesus, saw the earthquake and what took place, they were filled with awe and said, "Truly, this was the Son of God."
Go ahead and take a seat if you can. In that garden, Jesus was feeling the weight of the crushing weight of sin for the first time, because he knew he was about to be treated as sin was. He felt the weight, but he chose obedience. And in just a few hours in that garden, after a few hours, he was arrested. And after his arrest, Pilate, if you can remember, Pilate, to appease the Jewish leaders, ordered that Jesus be scourged. He ordered that he be tortured. Pilate's intent was to release him, maybe to torture him in such a way that would satisfy the Jewish leaders, but they weren't satisfied. He ordered Jesus to be tied to a whipping post and his clothes ripped off, and he was whipped with a whip called the cat of nine tails. And the cat of nine tails, it was a brutal, brutal instrument of torture. It was a long, not just a bull whip, but it was a long whip with many cords, and attached to the end would be anything that they could find, whether it be hooks or metal, glass, any shards, anything that they could find that would rip, that would catch and rip chunks of skin away. Jesus was tied to the post with his back exposed, and he was whipped 39 times, we're told. Many cords coming across his back, grabbing skin and tearing it off. You can imagine after 39 lashes. You can imagine, I don't know if you can, what his back, the whole backside of his body would have looked like. No skin left. You're probably seeing ribs exposed. After they beat him, they took him back, they mocked him, spit upon him, pulled out his beard, hit, smacked, fastened a crown out of thorns and beat it into his head. After all night all-night torture session that no man could withstand. They forced Jesus to carry his own cross to the place of the skull. This would have been a rough hewn, probably used by all accounts already, perhaps. Rough wooden beam. The weight in and of itself would have been a massive task. Under the beating and under the all-night, no sleep, the beating, the blood loss. Imagine the rough-hewn wooden cross on a raw, torn open back. Matter of fact, Jesus was fully God, but he was also fully man. And in his full humanity, he couldn't carry the cross the distance. So there was a guy named Simon from Cyrene. They grabbed him, and he carried Jesus' cross to the execution site. They would have stripped Jesus naked, laid him on the cross, drove large nails, perhaps 8 inches, probably between the space between his two bones as they connected to his wrist, one between his feet, raised him up after they put a mocking sign above his head, King of the Jews. And as they raise the cross up and it thuds into the ground, there he hangs between heaven and earth. And it wasn't the nailing to the cross that killed during crucifixion. It was asphyxiation. You would hang on the cross, and you would have no strength, and you would droop, and your diaphragm would be compressed, and you couldn't get air, and you would die from asphyxiation. That's why when they needed to expedite the process, they would break your legs. They would break your legs so that you couldn't push up to grasp to get a breath of air into your lungs. But the prophecy said that not one of his bones would be broken. And we know that it was on Friday, and it was the Sabbath was coming, and it had to be expedited. And so here's what we're told. It's from the sixth hour to the ninth hour. That would have been from noon, the sixth hour, until 3. It became dark. God the Father, Jesus crying out, "Why have you forsaken me?" The darkness comes across the earth. Now here's what's amazing. It's Passover week. It's Passover week, and if we go back to scene one to understand the significance, it's Passover week, and during Passover, every family that would come would bring a sacrifice. If you were a poorer person, God had permitted you could bring pigeons, but every family that could would bring a lamb to the temple to be sacrificed. It's estimated that in Jerusalem, on a typical Passover 2,000 years ago, there would be 250,000 lambs sacrificed. Now, here's the thing. They had to be sacrificed within a two-hour period of time between 3 and 5 p.m. Now, you can imagine 250,000 lambs, 250,000 lambs, slaughtered within a two-hour time period. The blood that would have flowed, a river of blood through the city. Between 3 and 5. And here's the incredible thing. Darkness fell from noon to 3. And at 3 p.m., when all those lambs were being slaughtered, Jesus cried out, "It's finished." And he died. Coincidence. There's no such thing, folks. This was written into the fabric of history before time began. God wrote your salvation plan before time began. If we go back to that upper room that night, it begins to maybe make a little more sense to the disciples. When Jesus picked up that glass of wine that night, this was different. This was a different Passover. He did something that it wasn't in the script. It wasn't in the ritual. It wasn't what they had taught before. They had never heard this. He picks up a piece of bread and he breaks it. They typically talk about the haste with which they had to leave, but now he says, this is my body. They're puzzled. What's he doing? This is my body. He takes a glass of wine, and rather than talking about, I will take you out, I will save you, I will redeem you, I will make you my people, he says, this is my blood. The very next day, his body would be broken and his blood would be spilled. He was that Passover lamb. He's the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. What he was doing that night was transitioning the Passover meal of the Old Covenant into the Lord's Supper of the New Covenant. It's a new memorial. We don't gather, or as Hasidic Jews still do to this day, to celebrate Passover redemption from Egyptian slavery. See, we're gathered tonight. We're gathered tonight to remember that we have been redeemed from the slavery to sin by the Passover lamb, by the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world, of all those who believe. That's what makes it so good. That, my friends, is what makes this so good. Oh, it was horrible for Jesus. Oh, but it's so good for us. What makes the cross so good? The cross is not good until it becomes personal. And I hope tonight it's become personal for you. Man, I could tell the sweetness of the room when we were singing that this is full of a bunch of people, man, who've put the blood of the Lamb on the doorpost of their heart. I could tell that. But I'm not foolish enough to think that every person in here has. And so if you want to know more about that tonight when this is over, we would love to talk with you. But right now, what we're going to do is, for all of those who have, we're going to remember. We're going to do exactly what Jesus did that night. We're going to remember, and we're going to participate in that new memorial called the Lord's Supper or Communion. We're going to participate in that. I'm going to pray in a moment, and we've got a lot of folks that's going to come down, and they're going to pass to you elements. And you're going to get double cup. There's two cups. There's juice. By the way, we use juice here in case anyone were to have any issue with wine. We don't want to set anyone back, so we use juice. You're safe. So there's a cup of juice, and there's another cup underneath that with a little piece of unleavened bread, like they would have had matzah. They had bread and wine. We have unleavened bread and juice, and they're going to pass it, and this is for believers. I just told you why. If you believe in Jesus Christ, this is for you to remember. For those of you who do not yet believe, this is for believers. If you have children that do not yet believe, we would ask that you hold them back from this. This would give you a great opportunity to go home and share with them why they are being held back from this. It's a great opportunity, as the Israelites, as the Jews, told their children about redemption from slavery in Egypt. This is a great opportunity for you to tell your children about redemption from slavery to sin that can be theirs. So if you're a believer, we want you to take one of these cups with the double cups and hold it. And we'll come back in a moment and we'll take this together. But until then, as Zion and Michael, Ben, as they're singing over us, what we want you to do is to reflect. Reflect on everything that's been said, everything that's been sung. Reflect on the fact that Jesus paid the price that you couldn't pay to give you what only he could give. Reflect. If there's anything you need to confess and repent from, then do so. Remember. Remember and be moved by the one who was crushed, absorbing God's wrath for you. Remember. Father, we love you. God, this is Good Friday. God, the only way it can be good is if it becomes personal. And God, I know that it's become personal for so many people in this room, and I pray right now, Lord, that we would reflect, upon who you are and what you've done. God, that we would, Lord, that you would bring into our minds any kind of conviction so that we can confess and repent, so that we can be renewed. God, so that we can literally be free of, Lord, the burdens that sin brings. Thank you for your broken body and your shed blood. We remember tonight. We even celebrate tonight because it's so good.